mic to Mia. If you can just ask everyone to take a seat, please. We're about to start. And then, Samia, if you could also close the doors at the back, please. We'll give it a couple of minutes for everyone to get some seats. There's still some seats in the front on my right. There's some seats in the front here on the right, if you guys are looking for some seats. Two over here. Is there a seat available somewhere? Is there a seat over there that I can see? Yep. Just a bit forward, yeah. Excellent. I think we can make a start. Good evening and welcome to this evening's program talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. A very special welcome to those of you joining us live online for the first time too. My name is Netanya Rolofsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary for SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program talk will be a discussion on hurricane clustering on Tuesday, 7 May. Further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. Our next social event will be a SIAS board games night on Tuesday, 30 April. Further details and tickets for this event are also available on our website. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students. Further details are provided on the website. There's an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on the way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get automatically added to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk, so please do take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. And especially to those of you watching online for the first time tonight, please do spare a minute or two to share your thoughts on how you found the webinar process. If the alarm sounds, During the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. And finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around an hour and be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talk, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA. Please clearly state your name and also which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. I've also been asked by our IT team to please ensure you hold the mics close to your mouth when asking a question. This is to accommodate our online audience, please. And then following the meeting, there will be snacks, sandwiches, and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so please do join us for that. Back to tonight's talk. I'd like to introduce Tim Gordon, who is the chair of the CMI Mortality Projections Committee. Tim will now introduce tonight's talk and our speakers for this evening.
Brilliant. Thank you, Natania. So, welcome to this joint CMI science meeting, which has become an annual event. So, as Natania mentioned, this is the first time it's going out live. So, we're going to take questions from web participants, but I think that will change in future years. Thank you ever so much to Natania and SIAS for hosting. There's a reason why we keep coming back and running this on an annual basis, because it seems a very successful formula. So, my name is Tim Gordon, Chair of the Mortality Projections Committee. I hope everybody knows what the CMI is, but quick rundown in case you don't. CMI is wholly owned by the Institute of Faculty of Actuaries, produces standard tables for the UK actuarial profession, and the points I would highlight is that it aims to be high quality and impartial. I think that, I'm biased, so I would think that, but I think we achieved that having seen how the CMI compares with societies around the world, and I think that's a credit to the quality of the people who volunteer for the CMI and actually the quality of the UK actuarial profession generally. Here's the running order for tonight. So I'm going to say a few things, make a few points, then I'm going to hand over to Cobus Daniil, who's a member of the Mortality Projections Committee and a longevity specialist at Willis Towers Watson. Then we have the first of our two external speakers, Dr. Tim Crayford, who is medical director at JUST, who has a background in epidemiology and public health, and Joseph Liu, who's science director at Legal & General, former chair of the Mortality Research Steering Committee at the IFOA, and is generally well known within the longevity industry. Following that, we'll take questions. And then Steve Bale, who is also a member of the Mortality Projections Committee and another longevity specialist, he will close summarising the discussion. So, I only have 4 points. It's helpful just to have a graph of what's happened so that we're all talking about the same thing. We've got some context. Here's an extract from a recent working paper from the Mortality Projections Committee. It shows mortality expressed as a standardized mortality rate. That means we don't have to worry about population growing, and so the points are comparable over time. Picture, kind of drawn some lines just to help everybody understand the picture. High improvements first decade, actually historically high, then relatively low improvements since 2011. So with that in mind, 3 points are, first of all, within the CMI, we have to be careful how we express things, but we are surprised that the CMI model gets applied without justification to subsets of liabilities, for instance, DB pension schemes. The model is calibrated to lives-weighted national data, and in a DB pension scheme, you're looking at a biased subset of that, because to earn a pension in a DB scheme, you have to be well enough to earn a substantial pension. And then within the DB pension scheme itself, the benefits are much weighted towards people with larger pensions who are also socioeconomically biased. So it would be an odd thing just to paste the core CMI model onto those liabilities without some further thought, because the evidence we have suggests that mortality improvements for people in higher socioeconomic groups have been persistently higher for the past 15 years or so. The evidence is not 100%, and no one's necessarily projecting that gap to carry on widening forever, but it does mean that you need to think before you take the core model and paste it on to, say, DB pension scheme liabilities. So with that in mind, Cobus is going to talk in detail about our new excitingly named parameter A, actually I think is an improvement on S-kappa. The aim of A is designed to be a little bit more intuitive because you can say what addition to the initial improvement rates would I like, rather than having to twiddle with S-kappa to try and get the effect that you would like. There was an ACA meeting last week where I think some people came away with the impression that you can't change S-kappa and A at the same time. Well, actually you can, but why would you? The complexity of your modeling should probably be commensurate with the credibility of the information you have, and you don't have very good information on current mortality improvements. So I'd be surprised if you didn't just use one, and A is the easier one to use. Final point of this slide is, I should just mention, if you fiddle with the advanced parameters in the CMI model, and if you take the advanced parameters, fiddle with the constant addition to mortality improvements by age, and then switch back to the core model. There was an issue with the initial software where the user interface didn't actually revert properly back to the core model. We found that out about that on Thursday. We fixed the issue, and the version uploaded to the website now, version 2, fixes that issue. It probably won't affect you unless you fiddle with the advanced parameters, but just in case, we're using every channel we have just to make sure that you're aware there was an issue. So the safest thing is, if you downloaded it last week or one of the previous weeks, re-download it, and then you won't have to worry about anything. Final point, just out of interest, I suspect quite a few people in the room are already aware of this. So this is the protein. It's a graph that's going to be coming out in the CMI's quarterly mortality monitor. This is based on data up to week 11. We will actually publish based on data to week 13. But there's something interesting going on in terms of mortality last year and mortality this year. So this is cumulative standardized mortality rate, and that's quite complicated, but essentially the difference between those lines is the mortality improvement using the left-hand scale between two different years. So if I were to look at the top two dotted lines, which are 2009 and 2010, that's roughly a 2% improvement in that year, where they ended up on the right. What's interesting is what happened at the end of last year. So last year, which is the dark line, started off very similar to 2015, very heavy. But then it steadily improved throughout the year. And what's interesting is this year has also been quite high improvements. Given that we had the last 3 years of last 2 years of virtually nil improvement, I think that's something to take away with. I would be the last person to suggest that you should use 1 year of improvements to do anything statistically sound, honestly. But there's food for thought there. Right, so with that, I will hand over to Cobus.
Great, thank you, Tim. Hello, I'm Cobus O'Neill, and like Tim said, I am a member of the CMI committee and also a longevity specialist at Willis Towers Watson. Now, today I'm going to talk a bit about CMI 2018, and to talk about that, it's always useful to consider a bit about the history of the CMI model. So we've only been running the model since about 2009, so it's only about 10 years old now. Before that, for those of you that can remember, we generally used cohort improvement. You had a choice of short, medium, and long, and you generally just applied a bit of a underpin to that. And it's actually remarkable how quickly things have developed over the last decade or so. So for a bit of history, between 2009 and 2014, we had a period of relative stability. We've had annual updates showing relatively stable improvements over time, as we would expect. Now, at the end of 2015, or during 2015, we were starting to see some new data coming through showing quite low improvements. We were a bit worried that these have been a blip and that they may unduly influence our projections. So we had a bit of a rethink, and following that, introduced CMI 2016, where we've made some bigger changes. Most notable, the introduction of a smoothing parameter that allows users to control how much emphasis is placed on later data. We've also made a change to the shape of the long-term rate taper, so where the taper reduced from your long-term rate between ages 19 and 120, that was brought forward to 85 to 110 reflecting actual experience and what we've seen in the data. Following that bigger change, in 2017, we had a run-of-the-mill update. But that, in that point in time, it became clearer that what we were seeing was not a blip in the reduction in mortality improvements. It seemed to be at least a short-term trend, and there was growing consensus about it. And we were getting a bit worried about the model not representing or showing that trend quickly enough. So with CMI 2018, there was a change in the probably the makeup or the view of the committee as a whole, where previously we thought a smoothing parameter of 7.5 was probably within the centre range of the committee's views. We then realised that we're probably looking at it at being at the higher end. So we consulted on reducing the smoothing parameter from 7.5 to 7. During that consultation, we got very useful feedback from US users, pointing out the key point that we wanted to reflect but should have probably considered a bit more in previous iterations, and that is the need to reflect different subpopulations. So while we fit the CMI model to population mortality, often it isn't used in that day in way, and we users want to reflect how this subpopulation may differ from the wider population. So we know many users have used the smoothing parameter for this purpose. We considered that it's probably the right way to do it, but there are better ways of doing it. At the smoothing parameter has a few weaknesses in that it doesn't always have a stable meaning over time. So while in some years a smoothing parameter, high smoothing parameter could be considered prudent, in other years it will be imprudent. For that reason, we quickly came up with a new parameter, the addition, which we think much better suits the purpose, and we hope that people start using. We'll continue to monitor things. If we see that the period smoothing parameter is used less and less in practice, we may at some point decide to drop it from an advanced parameter, but it's way too early to really say what we'll do. We'll continue to monitor the situation. Another tiny adjustment that was made to the model was as a result of the High Age Mortality Working Party, and they were looking at higher ages. We followed the recommendations to adjust population data for the over 85-year-olds. That led to an absolutely tiny marginal change in our projections. So the next slide shows all that in a visual representation. So it shows life expectancies, how we expected it to increase under each model. So the grouped lines at the top represent CMI 2009 to CMI 2014, the golden years of mortality projections when they thought everything was going to be easy and data was going to behave well. Then the purple line shows CMI 2015, where we saw that lower rates making its way into the model. CMI 2016, we've seen those changes. So the change in 2016 was probably tempered a bit by the choice of smoothing parameter, but we had the additional effect of a change in long-term taper, so that's why there is quite a big step down. CMI 2017, run-of-the-mill change. CMI 2018, right at the bottom, probably just less than half of that change is due to new data coming in, but the largest part of that change is just change in smoothing parameter from 7.5 to 7. So now thinking about initial improvements, and it's useful to consider that those changes in the CMI model and changes in life expectancies are driven primarily by changes in current initial rates of improvements that we're observing. They're all done using the same long-term trend assumption. And thinking about how we want to adjust it and why we want to adjust it is quite a key point, and we've been doing some analysis on that. So, to make it clear, the CMA model is intended to represent a best estimate fit for England and Wales population data. Now, when we look at other groups, say, dividing that population in socioeconomic groups, so for those that don't know, I always get this wrong, but IMDs 1 to 3 is low socioeconomic groups, IMD 8 to 10 is more affluent people, IMD 4 to 7 is that 40% in the middle. And we can clearly see, over, that's now over 2008 to 2015, but actually we've seen the trend from 2001 when IMD data was first published and then that we can use, that higher socioeconomic groups have experienced better improvements. We've seen the same thing on the SAPS data, now knowing that the SAPS data is a much smaller data set, and the confidence levels that we put there are observational, so difference between two-point estimates and don't necessarily tell us too much about the actual underlying trends or how much of that is systematic differences versus just idiosyncratic differences. But it is quite clear that different populations have experienced different improvements, and makes it quite clear that at least users should consider whether they should adjust their initial improvement assumption to allow for how their population may differ from the wider North and Wales population. So two ways of doing it. We've already talked about the S-kappa, so placing more or less emphasis on more recent data moves up or down your initial improvements. That is a slightly roundabout way of going about setting your initial improvements. Unfortunately, that was previously the only way that was easily accessible to users, and that led us to introduce the new initial addition to mortality, snappily named, which was introduced in 2018, and which we really hope people would use and found helpful. Now, that addition isn't a constant addition over the whole age range, so it's a constant addition between ages 20 and 85, but like the long-term trend, it tapers down to zero between ages 85 and 110. And a key point there is that it doesn't only affect your initial rates, say in 2018, it actually goes back to previous periods too, so it will affect your improvement assumptions between the base date of your base table and from that point forward. So that's just something to keep in mind. So if you ever do experience analysis using a particular improvement table with an adjustment, just be clear that if you change the adjustment, you may want to update that analysis too. More complex, and actually the initial addition type changes were always possible using advanced parameters. Putting it into the extended parameters just make it easier for most users to do. Currently, the model doesn't allow you to update the addition as an extended parameter and then other advanced parameters. We've had some subsequent feedback that is something that users will actually like to be able to do, and we are looking into it, and we are going to look to implement some extensions to that over the next year or so. We're going to look to do that before CMR 2019, I think. So how much to adjust initial rates of improvement? I'm going to disappoint everyone here. We're not going to quote, as a committee, we're going to quote a range. I'm not going to quote a best estimate. It really depends on your purpose and the population you're looking at. What we can do is provide a bit of guidance. So in working paper 119, you've seen a long list of points you need to consider when setting that initial rates. Some key ones is the statistical credibility of the underlying data you're looking at. So for instance, IMD data, yes, clearly higher socioeconomic groups have experienced better improvements. Is this systematic? More probably than not. Will the drivers underlying that continue in the future? A bit more of an open question and how they may change. Also, a key point to consider is what is going to happen in the future. Are we going to see continued divergence? So currently, what you are modeling is a difference at the initial point, and you're already allowing for convergence at the long-term rate point, so in about 20 years. Now, you may consider that that convergence is actually going to take place much sooner, maybe over the next 5 or 10 years, or it may reverse at some time in the future. Those are all the type of considerations that we think people will go through and will consider when setting these assumptions. Thank you. And over to Dr. Walker.
Good evening. Thank you very much. As Tim said, I'm the clinical director at Just PLC. We're a company based in London and Reigate and specialise in selling retirement financial products, including enhanced annuities, which is a product which I'm very closely associated with, having a strong hand in designing our automated underwriting system. That's given me a particular interest in longevity improvements, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about this evening. Specifically, how good could population longevity ever become? The perspective that that I've taken is to stretch out from some work, that some academic work done by Jim Vopel and others, which I'll refer to later, which has looked at different populations around the world and has generally shown that they tend to be getting a lot healthier as time goes on. He seems to think that they'll carry on doing it forever, and I don't. So part of the reason for that is talked about in this evening. Perspective that I think is quite enlightening, which is to move away from the general population and say, well, how healthy could general populations become, and to look at a subset which is increasingly becoming available to us now, which is people which I'm going to define as super healthy. I'll come on to how it's possible to do that using some data that is increasingly available to us. So what is the data in this super healthy group, and is it any different from population? And what does it tell us about where longevity improvements could potentially land? The question I'd like to fall back to is it ever credible that we could have a population that is ever like what we say is this super healthy group? Briefly, medically underwritten annuities, which is the context here, have been around since the 1990s. They're an increasingly sophisticated marketplace. One of the reasons for my personal interest in this is that the underwriter basis that we need to develop, it is underpinned by a sense of a flaw. So there, in that basis, you have to have a sense of there are some customers who have nothing wrong with them. They never have. They come to you at a pensionable age. They've never had any illnesses. They're not on any medications. They're not overweight. They're not underweight. They've never smoked. They live in good postcode areas. You can identify these individuals. And you can also do that from large population databases. Now, it is those individuals who arguably are going to be amongst the healthiest people in society. Now, if you put that into an industry context, obviously we're running mortality improvements forward, and across the industry we're seeing improvements running at about long-term improvements running at about 1.25, 1.75%. So the perspective that I would say is if you make some fairly elemental assumptions about population longevity, and you say, well, if it is to run forward at, say, an average of about 1.5%, how long would it be before everyone became super healthy? What is the implication of that? And is that a credible state for a human population, which in 50, 100 years' time is going to look pretty much like we do today? They'll have the same genes, same risk factors pretty much, and unless everyone's going to the gym and eating exceedingly healthily every day, they'll probably, I would argue, be dying maybe at a slightly healthier rate than us, but is it ever credible that they could become extremely healthy? So, I had a look around for some data which we might be able to use to construct a population life table of these extremely healthy individuals, and I've run the population table for to see approximately when it might converge with that. So good source of data for this and is the clinical practice research database. That's available from the government, but largely now to academics. It was previously made available to the industry, and I've collaborated with Matthew Edwards of Lewis Towers Watson in putting together this table. I've also worked with some colleagues at SCORE, and there is some other academic research which you can triangulate against this table. I'm only going to talk about the one today because I've got limited time, but it shows a not dissimilar feature. So there are other sources of data where you can define similarly super healthy subsections. And the question is, are they similar in some way? Do they appear to have similar underlying mortality rates? And how different are these from your average population mortality? So you can see CPRD is probably the best of these, and it's been around for a while. And from that, I've been able to identify people with no heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, respiratory disease. They've got good HbA1c, that's a biochemical marker of diabetes management, good body mass index, if I'm overweight, underweight, and so forth. So it is possible to identify that cohort. And approximately, this is what it looks like. I'm going to show another slide which demonstrates this a little bit more clearly in a minute. But the bottom blue line on that slide, these will be available after the meeting, obviously, so I won't go into too much detail here. The bottom line there is this, what I'm going to describe now as a synthetic cohort, because I feel it's pretty impossible at the moment for a cohort to be identified like this. These are people who are always healthy. And so they defined that you have to be in that state that on the previous slide, i.e. the absence of anything, and some positive factors at the beginning of the year, and we'll count how many deaths happened within the year. And then we'll reset the clock at the start of the next year, and we'll tot up how many people again fall into that same state, tot up how many of them die. So it's an interesting and rather unusual perspective. So just referring, though, back to Jim Bofill, this is the figure which I tend to take exception to. He says quite amusingly how wrong the industry has always got improvements over the year, and surely we should have just extrapolated this curve inexorably upwards. And conveniently, well, you can see by 2040, he's reckoning that we'll have a human population somewhere made up of a whole heterogeneous mix of people in different states of health, which will be living to 95, and that's the point I would wish to take issue with. Now, an alternative perspective, and I'm sure many of you here have also heard J.L. Shansky talking about his perspective, which usually he argues violently with Jim Bofill about, which is that while we've seen good improvements in longevity, you could potentially take out whole sections of disease. This figure shows, there's reference on the figure if you're interested in it. He was arguing, well, look, you could wipe out cardiovascular disease or cancer, and you still wouldn't get longevity going that high. So just how good could it get? Well, both of those perspectives came before the databases were available to us, like CPRD, and I would argue that gives us the ability to ask this question, how low can you push mortality? So I'm going to go back to the CPRD-derived table that I showed you a few moments ago, and I'm going to compare that with, on a log scale here, so this is worth dwelling on for a moment, the population in slide table 17 is the blue line at the top here. The orange line is the what we define as the super healthy males, and the dotted blue line is the ratio between the two. And you can see them running at about 20 to 25% of population. So that's an interesting perspective to start. I would say, with that definition, synthetic group, difficult to conceive how you could identify a human population that would fall to a mortality that is lower than that. Very happy to debate that point afterwards if anyone has any questions. So, just to jump to the chase, if you follow that life table from the age of 65, I'd say the healthiest life expectancy that you could see from the CPRD in the synthetic table is about 94. If you apply some simple assumptions to ELT 2017 and run those forward, that would converge in just over 100 years' time. Now, it's a very long way away from any assumptions that we're making today, so I have no qualms about the long-term assumptions that we're using now, because they're not reflecting risks that are that far into the future. But there is more of a philosophical point about how sensible is it, but how healthy could we become? These just slides just show simply different annual rates of improvement from, say, the year 2017, saying under different improvement assumptions, is it likely that you could converge towards this life expectancy of 94 in males, saying, well, even under a 4% rate, you probably couldn't get there now, but in 50 years' time, you very possibly could do. So it wouldn't take you wouldn't have to have improvements going on at much of a higher rate in 50 years' time before you would converge what I would say is arguably a ceiling beyond which I'd like to see yet reasonable evidence that you could get beyond it. Now, it is quite possible that you could get beyond it, because the way I've defined the cohort is largely the absence of things, the presence of a few healthy states, postcode and so forth, you're not able to identify people with good diets or good patterns of exercise out of general practice databases. So I can't factor those sorts of things in, and I would say it is arguable that there might maybe subsections of that healthy group that I have defined that could potentially today be dying at slower rates. And also, we've seen evidence in some of these healthiest groups. In fact, it's Joseph's work says that some of the higher rates of improvement have been experienced by the healthiest groups. Would we see higher rates in this group going forward? And if so, where would they come from? Well, I've got a few questions about that, and I think Joseph's going to address some of that in his talk. So if you're interested, this is some reasonable evidence looking at differential rates of improvement from Joseph in different socioeconomic groups. So we found that in this very synthetic group, we've got attained life expectancy of about 93, age 40, about 94, age 65 in males. And just to re-emphasize, the way this group has been defined, what it actually means, or what would have to have happened in order that you could ever have this group, is that you would essentially have had to have eliminated all extant diseases that people have in the population today. So anyone in this room today contributing to this cohort, we have just made you better. You've never had the disease that you had before you entered our life table. In fact, your nasty smoking habit, you never had that either. It is such an unrealistic perspective, I would argue, that when you can find these people, it is difficult to see how you could approach there, unless we can do something. There are things in the pipeline that will do things for even healthier people, to make these people even healthier than they are today. Now, I wouldn't write that out either. So I'm just going to consider that very briefly. You'll often see reported in the press that people will be living up to the age of 100, or is it 120, or whatever it happens to be today. It's from these super healthy people, who are arguably about as healthy as they can get, to get them up to 100, you'd have to lower their rates, mortality rates, by 50%. To get them up to 120, they'd have to go down by 87%. And to get the population as it is in ELT 2017, you'd have to knock out 90% of the mortality. And it's, you know, again, I find it very difficult to see how in normal human populations, short of a few things, genetic modification, new drugs that you're going to give to healthy people to make them live longer and so forth, there are a few things. You could spread statins out ever more widely. You could get vaccines against having too much cholesterol in your blood. There's a new drug called metformin, been around for a long time. There's tangential evidence that that may reduce mortality, possibly even in healthy people. The evidence today is not particularly credible. That even a drug like metformin is going to reduce mortality in healthy people. In fact, there's a trial that has just started a year or so ago, a randomized controlled trial that's trying to recruit enough people to look to examine just that sort of issue. So in answer to the Daily Telegraph, I don't really think we're going to be seeing humans living to 120 anytime soon. I'm not saying it's impossible. I just think it's unlikely, and there isn't a lot of evidence out there at the moment that we will. So that's largely where I want to leave it. Tim and Joseph.
Thank you.
Joseph, over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have heard about the slowdown in mortality improvement from Tim Gordon. According to the CMI 2018 paper, we have seen the 5 years moving average of annual rate of mortality improvement drop from 2.5% to 0.5% per annum over the last 5 years. And this has led to a release of billions of pounds in a reserve relating to longevity in insurance or in pension funds. Well, this recent mortality trend is financially material, but what could be even more financially material is the outlook of future mortality improvement. So I'd like to discuss how the mortality rate in the last 5 years might affect the future outlook of mortality rates from the perspective of a mortality reduction framework. There are lights? No, it doesn't have lights. It's okay, I just wave my arms a bit more. Mortality reduction framework. Well, this is the standardized mortality rates in England and Wales for males and females and total population. We have seen it reduce over time, and the numbers comes from kindly provided by the CMI from 1978 to 2013. Suppose you are a modeler, and you model reduction in mortality rates, you want to say, what is going to happen in the future? Let's take us 5 years back in 2013. You can say, let's draw a straight line, easy. But if you draw a straight line, you're going to hit zero and negative, and say, no, that's not allowed, we are mortals. So you want a way to have a limit to this reduction, and then you consider various factors that might determine this limit. You can reduce it. For example, you can consult Tim Crayford. He said that there's a limit, perhaps a limit. You thought about that. You say, yes, we are mortals, and there are barriers to this medical reduction. You can't really produce such a big improvement. There could be worsening risk factors, obesity, and there could be antibiotic resistance, health, social care problem, austerity. The patient's uptake, you can come up with the best drug to make people live to 120. It would only work if they want to take it. If they don't take it, it's useless. There is a potential of increasing or reducing mortality rates further, you know, pushing death rates further. There are potential improvements in risk factors, medical advancement, potential in healthcare, and better use of existing technology. Then you say, all right, I can have a maximum reduction. There's no way that you can reach this barrier. It could be 60% reduction from today or 50%, whatever that number. And then you need to model, you might model how are you going to reach there from today's numbers to the future. Okay? That's the reduction model. I think one of the earlier CMI models has this feature, an asymptotic reduction and a way to reach there. And of course, as a modeler, you then switch off your computer and go home and come back in 5 years' time. And you came back in 5 years' time and say, how inconvenient, the reality did not obey my modeling. And that's where we are at. We have a reduction, and the trend of reduction has stalled. Okay? then we need to ask, you might want to ask then, what do I do? What has gone wrong? Do I need to change my modeling of the framework of reduction, the maximum reduction? Do I need to change the way I'm going to reach there, how I'm going to reach there? Then you might say, let's see what happened over the last 5 years. Okay. One of the more notable charts that I noticed over the last 5 years is this one. I think Tim Gordon has something similar. I like this one because it is a collection of death data from many countries in Europe. There are some 23 subpopulation there, and it provides the best estimate, which is the red color, and statistical boundaries. You can have this two standard deviation, which is the line above the red line. And then you have the four standard deviation, which is your more than your 1 in 200 years event, the other line. And you can see two things, really. The actual death rates have actually breached and exceeded that four standard deviation line. If you're a statistician, this is the right time to fall off your chair and gasp. It's bad news. It's either a bad model or bad news. And the second thing you notice is that there's 1 year that falls within those lines. So there are many people are proposing, you know, the reasons behind this. I would like to ask, you know, everybody here, you have been listening for a while, can I hear three possible reasons for that? Flu. Thank you. That's a good one. Second one. Okay. Circulating virus, flu. Next. That's a two. That's not right. That's the two of the same reason. Two more reasons, please.
Weather.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Austerity.
Good. Excellent. More? Right, so let's keep to my promise. Three reasons. It's possible it could be a combination of all that. I suppose for those who are austerity, who say austerity, there might be people who ask you, then what happened in 2015 and 16? Did you stop austerity? Did you start spending? And those who ask, talk about weather. Do we have evidence that we are colder in those 3 years, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, and so on? And in the UK, by the way, we see a very similar pattern. The high ones are very similar, except the 2018 and 19. We don't see that breaching above four standard deviations. It's all within two standard deviations. Bad, but it's not as bad as what Tim Gordon has shown. Mortality improvement has picked up. Now, that's picked up and left the flu and circulating flu. And those who suggest flu has a story, they say it's the different type of flu. It's the H3N2 flu. That is the more virulent, the one that kills more. That became the dominating circulating flu in those high years, 14, 15, 16, 17, 17, and 18. And the less virulent one, H1N1, appeared in 2015 and 16. And in the UK, 18 and 19 were the less virulent one as well, H1N1. So they have a story. They say, it's a type of flu. It's not just a flu, not just flu season, but the type of flu. And in addition to that, a very bad year in 2014 and 15 that really messed up my modeling was associated with a mismatch of the vaccine to the bad flu. So there are two things moving on here. The first, you need a bad virus, and secondly, you have to mismatch vaccine. Right. So where does it lead us then? Well, for projecting purposes, if flu is a factor and if vaccine is a factor, if that's the case, we could expect bad years if bad flu has come and bad vaccines or mismatched vaccines occurs again. But we could also expect lower deaths, like the one in 2015 and 16, it has happened before, if we get the less virulent H1N1 strain, or if we improve our vaccination programs through better matched vaccines, or more effective vaccines, or with more uptake of vaccines. So we don't need to have very futuristic method to increase mortality improvement. In fact, we may not even need to do anything if H1N1 were to come back and just sit back and have the austerity we want. So normalizing or return to 2015 or 16 levels of winter death in the next 5 years could lead to a rise in mortality improvement in comparison to the recent low. So those who deliberate about the future needs to consider this point. Just looking at my time, oh, it's 5. Wonderful, I haven't changed the clock. But yeah, how else can we improve mortality improvements and improvements in living conditions can help prevent, in addition to vaccine, could help prevent deaths. We have increasing financial instruments and methods to improve how people live. And another area that we could potentially get improvement in death rates is just by looking at the rich-poor gap in death rates. It suggests that there's potential for improvement through existing knowledge. If we look at this chart, Cobus, you have showed us about improved mortality improvement by different socioeconomic circumstances. And this is a chart that shows death rates of 5 quintiles of subgroups of people in England and Wales according to socioeconomic circumstances as measured by index of multiple deprivation. It's a mouthful of ways to describe them. Basically, the most affluent fifth have experienced a lower death rate when compared to the others. And one thing to notice here is that the most affluent fifth tend to be about 7 to 10 years ahead of the average population. Yep, they're 7 to 10 years. So if you want to know where the average is heading in 10 years' time, in 7 years' time, perhaps we just look at those more affluent ones today. That is where perhaps they're heading. So there's potential using existing knowledge for mortality reduction. Another place where we can find mortality, driver of mortality improvements is, of course, medical advancements. So by medical advancements, I meant the process of developing a knowledge from science to preclinical trials to clinical trials and sell it. Now, I'm not going to be here to tell you that we're going to live to 1,000 or 120. Somebody else can do the job better. But I'm going to highlight a few things that I've noticed over the last 5 years from the investment community, because it is the investment that will sow the seed for improvement into the future. Now, I'm going to focus first on the first two sites, which is the science and preclinical stages. This is a chart of the count of number of deals funded by venture capitalists. Right? The venture capitalist funding for science has started more than 20 years ago and have become mature. They're not new, but they have become more and more certain and mature. What they do, do you know what they do? They identify potential sciences and laboratories, they look at good professors and hopeful science, they form a business around them, protect their IP and fund them properly, and help them produce and sell their solutions. There have been more deals struck in the last 10 years than 50 years before that. But success is a number game. That's why I use numbers. You only need a handful of these to be successful, to have an impact on treatment of fatal diseases. And as a rule of thumb, there are about a third of these are invested in cancers related, and that's mortality related. It's not just there for morbidity purposes. Morbidity means, you know, joint pain and blindness and death or hearing. These are the things that don't kill people, but they're well worth investing in. But we have investments in oncology, in cancer. So there we are. There's a potential driver. And the investment community has also been attracted to the anti-aging science that Tim Crawford mentioned. One of the areas is what they call the zombie cells, senescent cells. These are the cells, they don't die. You know, if something goes wrong with the cells, they can kill themselves. This is the apoptosis. They can kill themselves. Or some cells, they become immortal. That's cancerous cells. But there's somewhere in these are cells, there's somewhere in between. They just fall asleep. What they do is they spit out lots of chronic inflammation, and as a result, it leads to symptoms that are associated with aging, like that mouse on your right-hand side. The mouse on your left-hand side lives 35% longer than average. That's because they manage to wipe out these zombie cells within them. So these are the drivers. We can, you know, we can have your flu out there, but these laboratory activities still continue. That mouse still lives 35% longer. You can have austerity, but funding in venture capitalist funds continue to fuel all these. There's one other example, and the zombie cells is related to many, many conditions, and many of these are related to mortality. The next development that has attracted attention is stem cells research, and this is not just any stem cell research. This is an ambitious, it's quite an ambitious one in that they try to come up with off-the-shelf stem cells to treat us. The objective is for us to walk into a clinic and say that I need my heart valve replaced, can you replace that? And then they start making it and fit it in. So they have overcome some technical issues, including getting the stem cells in the first place, as well as trying to find ways to stop the body from rejecting these new stem cells and finding ways to purify and differentiate these stem cells. So these are some future medical advancements that could improve mortality rates. Now back to our day job as a modeler. You've got a trend, you have your projection, you have your 5 years of leveling, and you ask, what do I do with this maximum reduction and how to get to this maximum? Perhaps you want to come up with some big factors. We've heard from yourselves talking about winter death related to virus, cold weather, austerity, and some other various factors that might have changed over the last 5 years, and which one of these could change your view of the maximum reduction and how you're going to get there. And eventually you may come up with some possible way forward. The first one could be, well, nothing has changed. If anything, the medical advancement that you expected 5 years ago, some of them have materialized and others not. And what we have seen recently is but a deferral of your maximum reduction. So if we just push this reduction rate forward into the future, so you will get there eventually, but we're just 5 years late. Or you might say, well, we've seen enough breakthrough to help increase this maximum reduction, or we may reduce it following today's talk. But in a summary, the recent slowdown in mortality improvements is related to higher winter deaths. And it's likely to be linked to the more virulent flu viral strain, according to recent publication. And there are also concerns about funding of healthcare and social care and climate changes. However, there's still scope for continued fall in death rates through one, normalizing of winter deaths. I'm not asking for reduction, I'm just asking for it to go back to the 2015-16 level. Secondly, there's scope for improvements for better use of existing knowledge to improve health, as we've seen in socioeconomic circumstances, and of course, the medical advancements in the pipeline. Right, so welcome any question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joseph. So that ends the formal presentations. I'd now like to open the floor for discussion. You're welcome to ask any of our speakers a question or give a view of your own. So because this is being broadcast externally, please can you wait for the one true microphone, wherever that is, before asking your question or stating your view. And when you do that, please can you also give your name and whether, if you're an actuary, whether you're a fellow or a student. In my experience,
the number of students asking questions, usually numbers one or two, so just asking a question probably puts you in a very good chance of winning a bottle of champagne. Please don't be offended if I repeat your question for the benefit of our external audience. So, does anybody have a question? So, shall we take the chap in the middle of the room and then come to the front?
Hi, Mandeep Jagpal, fellow. Just two questions from me. The first one is, I know it's early days, but based on the feedback you've had on the model so far, has there been a preference between the initial addition to mortality and adjusting the smoothing factor? And the second question is for Tim Crayford. We spoke about how long can people live for, but for example, at Just Group, you have a lot of impaired lives of a higher socioeconomic background. What impact do you think there'll be from moving to CMI 18 next year for that kind of portfolio of lives?
So, would you mind repeating the first question? Because we didn't.
And who is it for?
Sure. You mentioned earlier that users of the CMI 18 model would either look to move the smoothing parameter or the new factor A.
Yes.
I was wondering whether you'd had any initial feedback on whether on which one was preferred by users.
Too early to say. Shall I do that, or do you?
I think we can both cover that. I think it's too early to say. We haven't seen anybody use those assumptions in valuations or within insurance submissions or anything like that. So I think we can't make a statement. I think in our own businesses, we have an idea of what people are going to use. Tim, I'm not sure if we could
talk about
that.
You can talk freely.
Yeah.
It's not a commercial thing, is it?
Yeah,
it's
not a commercial thing. I think in our firm, we've been hesitant using the smoothing parameter before. I think we'll be much less hesitant using the initial addition.
So in that context, I can tell you that my employer is strongly encouraging people to use A, because it's just, life is so much simpler for all the reasons with respect to the parameter in the first place. Tim, second question to you.
But the impact of CMI 18 on impaired lives, if I heard you correctly. I think we have seen in our sorts of portfolios similar sorts of improvements, and we would assume that they would continue as you would see in the population. I think there is an arguable case, which is not backed up by data, that certain types of conditions, if people have them already, may not be subject to improvements. But in the absence of data, I think that people working in the impaired industry will be using standard CMI 18 estimates.
Okay, so there's a chap at the front.
Simon Grout Fellow. I have a little bit of a ramble and then maybe a little bit of a question to Joseph, and I've taken my glasses off Tim. So if I go back to when I bought my first house in 1988, when we did the AIDS projections, I paid £32 for life assurance for 80,000. And then 4 years later, I paid £9.50 for 160,000. Exactly the same, my wife and myself. Joseph mentioned the 4SD, and that's what caused the financial crisis when we got credit risk wrong with 4SD. Obviously, the changes in longevity made the financial press, and we were all mentioned, and it was great to see actuaries in the Daily Mail in a positive sense, in that everyone was living a bit longer. My question is, if it goes the other way, and we see the graph turning around the other way, and suddenly the large annuity writers are putting up £1 billion extra in reserves. Have we taken a step back as a profession and thought, how are we going to manage that communication? Because obviously there's always a turn on the positive side of things. People are living longer, and that's all great for people, not so good for shareholders. But that was my observation from in particular, you know, it was, you're sitting next to each other, and I don't want to cause a fight between the two of you, but there was definitely one view on how is it ever going to get any better. And then obviously Joseph gave some examples of, well, we could all live to 130 in 100 years' time. And that's what I was thinking, that when I talk to trustees of pension funds and they hear these sorts of numbers, they get a little bit worried. And I was thinking it from that perspective as I looked through the presentation between the two of you.
In terms of where longevity might actually land, I think your concern was about the possibility that improvements could reverse themselves out now, that the impact of some of the things that Joseph highlighted, you know, the populations of the UK is certainly getting more obese at quite a rate of knots if you look at our young people. And all the evidence is that they won't shake that off as they age. That will probably stay with them, as will the lifestyles of themselves and their parents that led them to that state. So there have been forecasts made of that. It is possible that is going to contribute probably more in 10 to 20 years' time to what I think we all feel is likely to be a slowdown in improvements. Will it result in reversal? I find it difficult to predict because there are these new technologies that are in the pipeline. So many of them are full of promise. All the genetic therapies, the stem cell therapies, the fact we can now sequence the human genome, we can see exactly what's gone wrong. It does look as if we might have some really significant advances within our grasp. All I would observe is that they haven't materialised yet, and we've been talking about them for the last 20 years since we cracked the human genome. I very much watch this space, and you know, there's a lot of investment going into these new technologies, but they're really quite unproven. So how you balance what some of the problems that we know are going to emerge against the promise and all the potential, I find it quite difficult to predict.
With regards to what you mentioned about the release of funding as in good news from the trustees' perspective or actuarial perspective, I can remember back in 2004 when I first started looking into longevity as a specialist. And if you remember, that was the time when people say actuaries have been sleeping on the wheel, and that's what the FTs say, because they missed out this cohort coming through. If any of you can remember that. So we have, as a profession, we have seen that before. We have been criticized for under-reserving, and so that we can prop up the amount of billions of pounds that you just mentioned there. I think we cannot be complacent with this. This is only a very recent phenomenon that we start releasing reserves, you know, following so many years of needing to increase reserves. And we need to explain as a profession that, yes, they can come back up again because we've seen it coming back up. And how do we get there? It's actually not too difficult to come back up from the average of 0.5% that we've seen in the last 5 years. You just go back to the 2014 and 15 numbers and say, I don't like this number, and you just turn it into the average of the year before and after that. And very quickly, you can see that 0.5% goes up to probably 1.5 to 2%, and that's multi-billion pounds. Very easy to go back.
So if I just make a comment on behalf of the CMI, I'd probably draw a distinction between very good points you make about how do I manage reserves of an insurance company or funding of a pension scheme, and the job of the CMI, the Mortality Projections Committee, which is to get as good an estimate as they can. Not claiming to be absolutely best estimate, but trying to get something. So inevitably, there will be situations where we overshoot because that's how best estimates work. So, for instance, if we were writing software for a car, I wouldn't want to write it on the basis that, you know, we always turn one way until we're absolutely sure that we need to turn the other, because then I would just crash off the edge of the road. So there is something about best estimates, which means you will sometimes have those moments where you overshoot in everybody's benefit of hindsight, and the job of the CMI is to do best estimate. And it's the job of probably everybody else in this room to actually manage that information into funding, insurance company reserving. So there's a lady on the Second row.
Adele Groyer Fellow, this is a question for Tim. So very interested in your synthetic, very healthy group. How might that compare to some of the synthetic healthy groups elsewhere in the world? So what prompted that is legendary subpopulations with supremely healthy diets and lucky genetic inheritances.
There's been interest in these healthy groups for, I'd say, last 40, 50 years of epidemiology. So some of them have been described before. Seventh-day Adventists, for example, they live a very healthy and abstemious lifestyle. They've been studied quite extensively. But the studies are generally the whole Adventist population. So by definition, they're not all going to be healthy. Certainly not going to be super healthy, and they're not as healthy as this group that I've described. Elsewhere in the world, primary care information systems, which is largely where you have to go to build this sort of life table information, aren't as advanced as we have in the UK. So the other studies that I've looked at, which largely replicates what I'm saying about CPRD. There's another database called THIN. It stands for the Health Information Network. It's a commercially available general practice database, but again, it's based in the UK. You can identify the healthiest individuals from within that, and I've worked with partners in SCORE to be able to do that. They're running a life table about the same as the synthetic healthiest in the CPRD. It's unsurprising, they're both from the UK. They're both GP databases. So sadly, I don't at the moment have too many opportunities to read that across to other populations. Safe to say that the mortality models, there's a third general practice database that's generated a risk model called Q-Risk, which the algorithm's publicly available, and from that you can derive sort of super healthy table, not dissimilar to the one I've got from CPRD. So I think the ones we've got, three that I've been able to find from the UK, they're telling us not dissimilar things. But sadly, I don't know how generalizable it is. I suspect that, there aren't too many differences in fundamental mortality between different populations that aren't explicable by lifestyle or risk factors. As humans, you will find that people, for instance, when they migrate from other parts of the world to, say, the United States, where migration has been extensively studied, people do tend to converge to similar sorts of mortality rates. I think that there's something that probably unites us all in humanity, and you might see it in these super healthy populations.
So we've got two questions. Should we take? So I think Brian put his, the chap in the third row put his hand up first, and then the chap in front of him.
Thank you. Brian Ritzel, fellow. We've seen in the States and Canada this massive increase in deaths in opioids. Illegal opioids, then the Sacklers coming in and flogging legal opioids, and then the drug pushers learning from that and developing their systems. My question is, given our state, austerity first, possibly a chaotic Brexit and problems with the government over a number of years, have CMI, GAD, or any people like that factored in a risk for the possibility that we have a major opioid epidemic?
I can respond to that first. You might want to add to that. Several people, I've heard that question asked with concern on several occasions about the UK. But there are some things that are fundamentally different about the UK market in opioids, both the legal and illegal market, compared to the market in the US and Canada. So the US and Canada don't have the same restrictions on advertising to the public, and they have different restrictions on advertising to general medical practitioners. We also have the evidence-based body for the NHS, which is National Health and, Institute of Health and Clinical Excellence, or NICE, which has quite a lot to say about the sorts of conditions that might lead to doctors in primary care often prescribing opioids for their patients And in the UK, that guidance is very much that opioids are at the tail end of the spectrum. You don't use them because of the risk of dependence, so they're very much frowned upon. As a result, we've seen nothing like the epidemic, which in the States actually has its roots in the legal prescription of drugs, which led to dependence and then people needing to buy from the black market to feed that dependence. So that's why we haven't seen that problem over here. I'd argue that we're very unlikely to see a problem with its origins there. As it is, we've had, someone might correct me if I'm wrong because I don't follow this particularly strongly, but I don't think we've seen any major patterns in illegal opioid abuse. I think the changes that have come recently, more recently in the last 5 to 10 years, have been increases in crack, cane, and crystal meth.
Just a comment on that. Yeah, that highlights the importance of considering different factors for different countries. For companies that have say bulk buyout annuities in the UK and US, they may need to consider this, and they also need to consider the issue of substance abuse between different socio-economic groups, whether they will affect different strata of the society and age group, because that has a different uptake as well.
So in answer to your question, not that I'm aware of, no, we're not planning to include that in our modelling. I'm aware that it does preoccupy our US colleagues, but it's not such an issue here. I think Joseph's right to highlight the fact that sometimes there are locally based mortality issues. But the CMI, we have trouble just getting to a view on a fairly general model of future mortality improvements. Once you factor in cause-based modelling, we are in a world of... It would blow the budget, which I've already done once or twice, and I don't want to go there. And it would be very complicated. And if I look at the range of outcome predictions from cause-based models, they themselves are really quite disparate. So there's a whole set of reasons why CMI sticks to what it thinks it can do sensibly for the benefit of its subscribers. So, chap in front of me.
Gareth Mead, fellow. Question for you, Tim Gordon, actually, particularly in the light of Joseph's comments, and I think you alluded to it at the start of the presentation. CMI's moved away from collecting insurance data sets to now constructing based on population data sets, and I detected a cautionary note that perhaps pension schemes and insurance companies may have been too soon to adopt the CMI models without adjustment. Could you comment on whether you think people have been too soon, have released reserves too soon, or if in fact recent mortality trends justify the billions that have been wiped off reserves?
Well, I'm definitely not commenting on the latter, but I think there's a question of balance. So the CMI hasn't stopped collecting insurance data, just like it collects data for pension schemes and the SEPs investigation. There's a question of what can you do with the data? So to get the CMI model to work, it's hard enough with a data set that goes back to 1961 to get something that sensibly attributes mortality trends between age, period, and cohort. It's not actually that unambiguous as to where all these effects go. So it's really hard when you have a data set that goes back more than 40 years, which is reasonably homogenous. When we start cutting the data size, set down in size, we have other drift factors. So the fact that we might have an insurance data set, but insurers move in and out of that data set, just like pension schemes move in and out of the SAPS data set, you probably have some drift over time with the memberships. All those can masquerade as mortality improvement. And we've seen a number of graphs tonight about how volatile mortality is on an annual basis. So trying to get to the underlying trend, I feel like this is one long whinge, and I've got a few more I could whinge about, but essentially it's really hard. So getting mortality improvements out of pension scheme data and insurance data really challenging, and even if you've got a number, you've done some analysis, you've got a number, breathe on it, do it a different way, and you probably find that number moves quite a lot. So it's really a sense of maybe a nudge on the tiller rather than let's just go and throw what we've got away, because you don't have that good a feel, that a good information on what the mortality improvements are for pension schemes. And even if you did know what the mortality improvements in pension schemes have been compared with the national data set over the last, 15 or 20 years, you're still in a quandary as to what you do about rolling them forward, because there's still a question, do they carry on diverging if that's what we think is happening? Do we think there'll be a reconvergence? Joseph suggested there might be a lag between the better off actually trailing the path the least well off, but that's not a given. So even with all that, it's uncertain. So we do the best we can, which is use the one credible data set and then tweak it, given other bits of information. It's essentially core actuarial work, is you're trying to make sense of data which is quite uncertain. And so I don't think it's a wholesale difference to look at what you do for a subset of liabilities, but you do probably want to know to the model. So we're not expecting people to stick an answer in for A, and Cobus, tell me if I'm wrong here, but like 5%, I think the model will actually throw an error. It will actually tell you, I think you put a stupid number in if you put, is that true, John? Yeah, I think you put sillier numbers in. So all I'm saying is it's a small adjustment. Yeah. And we don't have that good a data on that either.
We've had some really good questions from fellows. Are there any students out there who want to ask a question?
Think of the quality of alcohol. Price.
One additional observation to that question, and that is just when you look at CMI 2017 and with the smoothing parameter of 7.5, the initial rate that was producing was probably about 0.5% above the 5-year average observed in the population. Now with CMI 2018, that we're using a smoothing parameter of 7, with the core parameterization, we're getting much closer to the population average.
So it's Gareth's second part of the questions, but Tim won't answer that, but may I touch on that?
Yep, I think
what do we do? You know, there's a lot of money involved, trillions of pounds are reserved for longevity related. I think we need to discuss and think through that a large amount of funds are associated with very little data points and associated with some very volatile seasons, very short period of time, and in itself influenced by limited factors. We're not talking about 50 factors, either which one is affecting us. We can perhaps narrow it down to a few that we've mentioned today, flu, not just flu, the type of flu, vaccine of flu, somebody said weather, and austerity. So I think the key is to think through the issues and make the decision and making sure that people are comfortable after thinking through those issues and release or not release those funds.
Same. Does any student want a bottle of champagne? All you've got to do is ask a question.
Otherwise, we'll just hand it out to two fellows this month round.
Wow. Hey, Matthew Wharton, student. This might be a completely speculative question and a bit of a waste of time, but I wouldn't mind getting champagne. So, there was some mention of the improvements for higher socioeconomic groups being sort of noticeably better than for lower socioeconomic groups, and that gap widening as time's gone on. Do you imagine there's a limit to that gap, or could it just keep growing and growing as time goes on?
I think that there has to be a limit, really, doesn't there? You can look at populations of the world living in extreme deprivation, which is potentially where one point of that gap could be, and you could look at very affluent populations, which is presumably where the other end could get. And within that limit, you've got secular drivers that may operate in the UK on different ends of what is our spectrum, to push them in opposite directions. I think what you can observe from data such as Joseph's analysed before is that in recent years we have seen drivers operating in different directions for people at opposite ends of the social spectrum. At the end of the 1970s and 1980s, There was also then something called the Black Report, which commissioned to look into social inequalities in the UK, and it was quite instrumental about setting the agenda for the health services in the 1980s, although the then administration wasn't very happy about what the report was saying, where similar pictures, as we have observed in recent years, emerged. So you were then seeing the highest rates of improvement in the higher socioeconomic classes, and at the time the focus was simply on the gap and whether it was ethical to have societies that had that much inequality in health. So I think, yes, there probably is some sort of ceiling. I don't know where it is for how wide that gap could be. My suspicion is that at points, as we've observed in recent years, it will open up. I'm sure it will converge again, and it will do that more rapidly if other forms of social inequality are narrowed.
It's a very good question, well-deserved champagne. It has been asked in this place for many times and many years now. I remember back 7 or 8 years ago, there was a presentation here. We presented something here. We looked at the socioeconomic gap between different IMD, and we found that the gap was big, it was increasing. And at that time, exactly the same question. When is it going to close? Got to close. It can't keep going up. And guess what happened? The gap between the poorest and richest fifth used to be 50% difference, and it's now gone up to 85%. And we ask good question again. It's got to close. It can't keep going up. But who knows? I think it's we need to continue to keep track of things.
Right. So I think we have time for one more question. If you're a student, you could be in with a 50-50 chance of a... Sorry.
Thank you. Andrew Hunt, not a student, unfortunately. My question's for Tim Crayford. I was very interested in your approach. It's a relief to know that the ultimate mortality rates that you're getting are far enough into the future that the robot that takes my job is going to have retired before we hit them. The assumption going on in there is that it's a kind of static target. And so my question to you is, can we get you back in 5 or 10 years to rerun the analysis on data sort of in the future and compare it to see whether your ultra-healthy cohort, some synthetic cohort, has experienced any improvements over the next 5 to 10 years? Presumably you can't look at them in the past because the data isn't available. But well, it'd be interesting to see if they do get any improvements.
Interesting you say that. I think the data is available. It hasn't been available to me, and that's the problem. I was very interested in just that question because, obviously, if I'm going to be talking about the possibility of some sort of ceiling to human longevity, it wouldn't be a bad idea to look into the recent past to see if this super healthy group was just as super healthy as I think it has been on average. So, as I say, with some regret, I'm not able to do that because that data isn't available to me. It is there, and if there are any academics in the audience, I would countenance you to go and knock on the doors of the CPRD and see if they'll give it to you instead.
Just to amplify on that question, I mean, have you ever wondered what results you would get if, hypothetically, and I accept the data's not there for this, you were to run that type of analysis you propose in, say, the 1930s when lots of people were smoking, but that wasn't necessarily regarded as unhealthy?
Well,
everybody have concluded, well, you know, once we wipe out the medical history, which doesn't include anything to do with smoking, everyone's going to live to, I don't know, 56 or something.
Well, in the 1930s, you saw very long-lived individuals in those days. Obviously, we have seen the very longest-lived, increasing both in number and the length of their life. But in the 1930s, I think this is part of my argument, really. The people who were alive then, they're exactly the same biologically as we are today. And if you identify the individuals in the 1930s who have never had anything wrong with them and never had any risk factors, absent treatments that are available today that will stop you from dying in 1 year, and there are many. So you would find a difference in the 1930s and today simply because of advances in medical care. So if you take people who die from heart attacks in the 1930s, we didn't have percutaneous transluminal angiography or coronary artery bypass graft, all the things that we would go straight in with today when they come in with a heart attack. But I'm sure that you would have found a difference back in the 1930s, but I argue that's probably attributable to medical treatment. I think more the interest would be across the 2000s, where we have seen a very strong population mortality improvement, whether that across the population has been reflected in the very healthiest. Because if it is, I wouldn't be entirely sure as to why that was, because treatment has been relatively consistent over that time, whilst population has been improving.
Comments on this?
Sorry, Madarabi.
So we need the microphone.
Maddy Bajekal, honorary fellow and academic. In answer to Tim's question, if he had the data with the CPRD, he could do that analysis. Unfortunately not, even if you had the data, because of the medicalization of the population, you will not find the super healthy any longer. You know, even the statin threshold has come down so low that, you know, it's very... Firstly, you know, you have a synthetic cohort, which I guess over time is reducing to a very small percentage when you get to the 80s, you know, for you to have robust sort of life expectancy estimates for all around that age. But, you know, somebody who has no medication is going to be very difficult to find.
A very good point. So we're aware that over the age of 65, half of the population is on a statin nowadays. The other half ought to be taking treatment for their high blood pressure, but only about half of them do. So Maddy's point about this group of super healthies is shrinking ever further and further is absolutely well made. The one thing I would say, which is that that drugs like statins actually work, and I think it's arguable, and there is some evidence if you look at things like the polypill, that they might actually, by shifting the population distribution of serum cholesterol down, those are part of the class of drugs which you could give to the super healthy, and you might make them even healthier. So I wouldn't say that. So I think in due course we could relax our definition of super healthy because some people will be taking drugs preventatively.
Okay, thank you very much to our speakers for entertaining presentations and interesting discussions. Thank you for all of you who contributed. The announcement of champagne will be at the end. I'm sure you're in suspense. So with that, if I could ask Steve to close. Thank you, Steve.
Before I do start, I'd just like to say I think it's we've had two very good presenters tonight giving their own different thoughts and perspectives over the longer term. I think it's prompted some great discussion, so please could I ask you to thank them in the usual way, please. In some of our last meetings here at SCIAS, we've tended to focus on the drivers of more recent and current mortality, so it's been really good that we've had a session on the long term and different potential areas to consider. We've had Tim considering the super healthy versus the general population and really taking a research-based assessment of maximum longevity and sort of plausible improvements that might close that gap over the longer term. And then for Joseph, very much an upbeat assessment on mortality improvements, very much the drivers being around slowing down of biological aging, stem cell research and other drivers. naturally, long-term mortality is going to be very difficult to predict, particularly when we're talking about assessing pension liabilities, many with durations of over 40 years. So naturally, the discussion that we've had tonight also recognises that with the potential there could be equally downside drivers on mortality improvement, be it slow uptake of technology over the longer term, barriers to that, other risk drivers, obesity, diabetes. But equally, we've discussed some of the short-term drivers that might equally impact on that. We've also had some good questions about the CMI model, in particular the updating of the S-kappa parameter, and also our addition to the initial parameters, that additional initial improvement rate. We welcome this feedback on the analyses that we regularly put out. Now that includes the quarterly mortality monitoring, the model itself, the various consultations that we put out, the meetings like tonight at SIAS, and we're very grateful for this. Equally, we're very welcome and opening to receiving feedback direct to us. We do respond to feedback, and if you've got any questions, we'd be very happy to receive them at projections@cmilimited.co.uk. James, would you like to take the...
Thanks, Steve. Evening, everybody. My name's James Tate. I chair the CMI Executive Committee. I'd like to thank all the speakers this evening for their engaging talks. But the real reason I'm up here saying something at the end is to say a big thank you to Tim Gordon for his years of service with the CMI. This will be Tim's last SIAS CMI meeting before he hands on the baton to a new chair of the Projections Committee. He joined CMI Exec in 2013, leading the Projections Committee, and also as my predecessor leading the CMI as a whole. I think it's fair to say the CMI and the CMI model wouldn't be in the strong and healthy place it is today without Tim's leadership, his hard work and the blood, sweat and tears he's put into CMI. So I'd like to personally thank him and thank him on behalf of the CMI. What he will do in the evenings at weekends without the CMI to entertain him, I do not know. But perhaps you can ask him over a drink later. Before you do that, please join me in a round of applause for Tim.
Excellent, thank you. Thank you all for attending tonight's talk. We've heard a lot of thank yous to the speakers, so you know I won't carry on, but thank you, amazing speakers. You've been amazing and fantastic, and you've shared some invaluable insights, and hopefully we can all take away something with us today. And audience, great questions. Very big thank you to the student over there for asking a question as well. It's always good to see the students getting involved, especially as SIAS did start off as a society where we could share, where students can share research and have their research challenged, and where students can grow and learn and stuff like that. So hopefully, you know, we can have more students engaging in this kind of activity. The champagne prizes, which you can come collect afterwards, goes to Simon Graff for asking the question on how to manage reserves and manage communication. I think it's an integral part of being actuaries to also look at our social responsibility and how to be more customer-centric. So I thought that was a really good question and very well answered by the panel. So do come collect your champagne afterwards. And then without further ado, our student prize goes to Matthew. Matthew, you asked a really good question and it was very well thought through, so do come collect your prize afterwards. And for all of those that attended and online as well, if you can just complete the online survey, which will be emailed to you afterwards, your feedback does really get looked at and is invaluable for us. There are networking drinks outside, so please do join us and come over, talk to our panel, ask any more questions you may have. And then we'll just draw the meeting to a close in the usual way by thanking the speakers.